You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist, a podcast and broadcast. It's essentially a series of lectures on philosophy and history, political science, largely from the Russian Orthodox point of view. But we cover many topics here because ultimately all of this stuff is closely related. Thank you, everyone who has been donating. That it means the world to me. You become a part of this movement, so to speak, and assists me greatly in maintaining my independence. Today we're going to cover something, and this should be the 8th of September 2024. If you recall, it wasn't that long ago, I did something on the crackdown on crime in El Salvador and how panicked the regime was that it was successful. Well, we're going to go a little further in that. Something that I've been looking at for some time, and I think I have a handle on it now that I could competently talk about it and connect it to everything that we normally talk about on here. And that is the situation in Mexico, so that kind of makes it a domestic issue, concerning drug cartels, the border, and the future of the state. Everyone realizes the simple fact that in the Mexican case, the Mexican government has failed to curb the activities of the handful of extremely powerful cartels that monopolize the drug trade. It wasn't that long ago people were talking about Colombia and Colombian cocaine essentially coming in through Florida. That was shut down for a number of reasons. There was a certain success. The Colombian army was able to curb that domestically, and the U.S. was able to shut down the Florida route, which meant that Mexico became the next best bet as the large cartels in Colombia and Peru lost power. And by the 1980s, Mexico really was just a transit hub for cocaine coming from areas south. Cocaine is best grown in the northern Andes mountain region. But once the cartels, Medellin and other infamous cartels, lost relevance or were beaten, Mexico then became a dominant player. A few problems. Of course, whenever you deal with anything Mexican, this is a domestic issue, but drugs, immigration, basic identity. The massive, unthinkably huge drug problem in the U.S. and how artificial it really is. Nothing could be more domestic or even intimate to an American as the situation with the cartels in Mexico. And they grew in power largely in the late 80s, maybe by the mid-90s. Mexico is a bit different from Colombia in the sense that it's much more difficult to govern. It's a huge country, with its regions being very different from each other, everything from desert to jungle, all in the same country, with the constant American interference, and of course American funding, in its politics and security policy. We know what happened in El Salvador. The minute the huge militant crackdown began to show promise and has been largely successful, the U.S. did everything in its power to derail it. It's part of the reason why I say the drug war, which could very easily be won, and has been won, including in El Salvador, is deliberately lost. The drug culture, of course, has always been there, but it didn't reach its mainstream acceptance until the hippie movement of the late 60s and very early 70s. That was an official regime movement which liberalized everything. So the drug problem in its current pandemic state is largely artificial in the creation of the regime itself decades ago. Being a drug dealer, Ken, you know, I just finished Breaking Bad for the first time. A great work of literature, very complex characters. And I was very impressed by it, as I was The Sopranos, although in The Sopranos case, I'm from that area. I recognize every street name. And Breaking Bad was, you know, tremendous complexity and quite a bit of rational and realistic depictions of at least the political situation. Mexico is very hard to govern, and it's divided into regions as well as the states, which differ very much, not only in topography, but in the local tradition and connection to Mexico City. The revolution in the early 20th century led to the constant demand for a highly centralized state. That changed just a generation ago, and now you have various parties. You have three major parties that now have a vested interest in maintaining power over these regions. It's a deeply divided country, racially and ethnically. Now, you have that all over Latin America. But in a place like El Salvador, of course, you have some of the Indians around. But of course, it's one language and largely one religion. That's not the case. Of course, it's one language in Mexico, but it's a patchwork of ethnic groups. The Indians have their own, very much like the reservation system, have their own customary law, which in this particular case turns out to be a very good thing. The authoritarian state that was established by 1929 in Mexico, created economic growth. It tried to create a single Mexican identity, and to some extent succeeded. Nationwide industrial policies, fiscal policies, Mexico City created what we can call a Mexican identity. You know, nationwide associations, nationwide professional organizations. But the rule of one particular party, the PRI is in its Spanish initials, the Institutional Revolutionary Party, kept the country together since right up until the 90s. Strangely enough, there was never a coup d'etat in Mexico since independence. But there is, kind of like in Italy, a tremendous north-south divide, with much of the money and power in the north, poverty in the south, in general. Marijuana was the first drug that got people wealthy down there. It was the first crop to actually matter. And like it was the case for some time in the 20th century, it was unofficially tolerated, but with the state as mediator. Bribery was, yes, of course, it's a rent, but it also was almost considered a form of taxation. Mexico was held together by the state in Mexico City. You had criminal groups, in the broad sense of the term. Now, of course, it's very well defined. But prior to the 90s, the state and the PRI was a mediator among these groups, a mediator among regions. But the development of the modern economy created a middle class, created tremendous differences in wealth. Even, you know, as far back as the 1970s. And what began to grow was this movement for decentralization. Once the state governed by the PRI went into decline, I mean institutionally into decline, the cartels, as well as regional violence, began to show itself and began to spread. Decades following, power-sharing agreements, a multi-party system, pluralism, transactional interactions, power-sharing. As the press really went after the PRI, sometimes for good reason, as being the monopoly party, which of course it was. But those kind of agreements and interactions with the singular state in Mexico City began to fall apart. Today, you have a polycentric system, and one of the biggest beneficiaries has been the cartels dealing with heroin, cocaine, and methamphetamine. Criminal organizations benefited tremendously from this new alignment. And one of the things that interested me concerning this was the use of the military, the army, as what turns out to be an ineffective tool against these very wealthy, very well-armed cartels, and why that is and how that came about. The lack of resources and manpower in the army, as well as a severe desertion problem, are part of the reason. The American press is searching for anything it can to attack the army, to render it ineffective, despite it still remaining basically popular among Mexicans. In order for a state to be seen as successful in the most general sense, the state has to control all of its territory, which of course today is not the case. It has to have, as we all know, the monopoly on violence and being able to manage competition among cartels and the cartels relative to the state. This competition is absolutely ruthless. Many areas, especially in the south and certain places on the coast, the state is very weak. And this is where cartels and violence take over in to the extent that it's a de facto cartel state. I mean, their purpose, of course, is to make money and to increase the possibility of their freedom of movement to the maximum level. They don't seek necessarily the overthrow of the state. They seek to neuter the state. One of the things that changed everything was the rise of the cocaine demand in the U.S. The tremendous profits, the value added of this chemical, and the enormous demand, which has to some extent been replaced by methamphetamine and opiates in the most general sense of the word, everything from synthetic to natural poppy-based opiates. But cocaine in various forms still is extremely powerful. They've created their own market. The problem is that when you have high demand in a country like the U.S., you know, the drug capital of the world, it's going to be a huge challenge to do much about it if you're in the Mexican government or anywhere else in Latin America. Cocaine changed the game for Colombia and then now later Mexico. You see organizations making enormous profits. They have today highly complex supply chains. They have their own economy. They've created their own market. And of course, most importantly, the complicity of many power centers in Mexico. One of the things that the cartels have needed, for a whole bunch of reasons, is the creation of their own militias. And one of the biggest problems, as of right now, is that these militias have become regular armies, lacking really only air power. One of the worst things that can happen to a government facing a very well-financed and motivated system of cartels is their fragmentation. And that's what happened over the last generation. The more fragments you have, each one quite wealthy. I mean, you have like six big ones now, but there's a few smaller ones. And then freelance security organizations, mostly ex-military, that can be used in solving problems the only way that they really can, unlike the earlier era with the PRI, is, of course, violence. And that goes for one another, as well as the state. Mexico now itself, it does have a weakish middle class, has its own market domestically for drugs. And of course, NAFTA helped bring all of this about. NAFTA, starting in early 94, made it much easier for these organizations to function. Now, I've mentioned the agreement, the tacit agreement between the PRI and the earlier cartels. And there's 10 of them. There's 10 agreements. There's 10, they call it the Decalogue, the agreement between cartels and the PRI government that dominated Mexico for so long. Number one, that there were no bodies in the streets. You want freedom of action? Fine. This is not going to be an okay corral situation. Number two, absolutely zero tolerance for sales to children. Number three, no media scandals. In other words, don't do anything to attract the media, and especially attracting media to the idea that we have this agreement at all. Four and ten are similar. Number four is that a chunk of your profits has to go back into domestic development. And number four is in the town, in the state, not 10 is the federal level. Number five, you want to operate. Once in a while, you're going to have to deal with some lower level guys getting arrested and some product being taken. In other words, they need to keep the show going. It's one of these things. Everyone knew it, but because there weren't a whole lot of alternatives, it was something that people went along with. Importantly, number six, there's to be no proliferation of groups. Ideally, there should be one, but two or three is tolerable. Number seven, there's no separate agreements with the courts or local governments. The state and the party is the sole mediator for any of these things. Number eight, mistakes, you know, the wrong guy gets killed or something like that, that's dealt with by the state, not among groups. Today, of course, many of these cartels have their own system of justice, rough as it is. Number nine, respect the boundaries, the territories among groups. And number 10, and probably the most important, is at the federal and corporate level. The agreement was you have to reinvest some of this money into economic development, really at all levels. In 2024, cartels are criminal conglomerates, huge in scope. They've created their own system, supplies, I mentioned, tremendously versatile and diversified. One of their biggest areas outside of drugs is the theft of oil and fuel. the American organized crime, that was mostly a Jewish thing in New York, the Jewish so-called Russian gangs, had a kind of a simple system for running fuel wholesalers without paying any of the taxes. Michael Francis was the point man, but it was mostly a Jewish operation. Fuel theft is a huge source of revenue, but they do the normal mafia-style things, you know, extortion, they do some human trafficking, they sell weapons, contract killings. In fact, they've created their own oligarchy. Now, one of the reasons, and I've said this before, one of the biggest reasons for the cartel's success and really the inability of any entity to defeat them is the fact that the American system of economics, the oligarchs, depend on money laundering. You're talking about billions and billions sent through the stock market, the bond market, to legitimize the money that they make. This is how they found legitimacy, and we all know that's where cocaine found its home in the 1980s. And the involvement, connection between American corporations and the cartels. Back in 2008, drug money was the only thing that kept the stock market functional. And any depression in the stock market would have been much higher had it not been for cartel money. Back in 2012, I think it was the HSBC, the British bank, laundering billions for years. And I think the case against them was over in 2012, 2013. And the punishments were, as you might expect, pretty weak. And so the slogan, too big to fail, was changed to too big to jail. And within those court cases, among other things, you had a full admission that the stability of the New York financial system is guaranteed to a great extent by cartel money. There's simply too much cash there for it to be ignored. The stability of the financial system, especially in 2008, but it's always been a part of it, is based on the influxes of this huge amount of cash. This is part of the reason why the cartels are simply too wealthy to defeat. No matter how many patriotic men go to their deaths, they now are an integral part of the American financial system. And why not? The same passions that drive this obsession with profit do the same regardless of the product that you're selling. Most of these cartel bosses could have easily been dominant in the corporate world. The same set of vices are necessary in both cases. The former head of the Drug Commission of the UN, Antonio Costa, admitted in more than one place that drug profits have a substantial role in the global economy. The UN, of course, estimates differ, say that drugs make up about 5% of the global GDP. This is why the situation is where it is. This shouldn't surprise anybody. When there's that much available money, there's not much you can do about it. The Chinese, however, did win their drug war just before they were forced open, the Opium Wars in the 1840s. The Philippines, at least for a while, won its drug war. Population got behind all of this. The population is behind the war in Mexico, too. And, of course, I've already mentioned El Salvador. Now, what the military may do, I mean, if there's ever a time for a coup d'etat, it's now, despite there being no tradition in Mexico for that, although they're surrounded by it historically. And they're able to afford, importantly, building militias of the world's top mercenaries and former Mexican federal police, former Mexican soldiers and sailors. Even they use women, young, attractive women, for various hits. And their weaponry, they have anti-aircraft, they have 50 caliber, everything. They even have their own, we'll talk about that in a minute, their narco tanks, which are just armored SUVs, and the APCs, armored personnel carriers, that they've bought from various parts of the world. They have RPGs, mines. What makes cartels different from any other violent force against the state is that they don't seek to overthrow it. They want to maximize their freedom. But in terms of murders that can be directly traced to cartels, 2018, you had 25,000 deaths, 26 in 2021 in Mexico. Their use of psychological warfare, the shock and awe of certain forms of brutality to demoralize the population. They've mastered that years ago. Cartels benefit from chaos. The left in general really does, although the cartels tend to be anti-communist. They were associated with the communists in Colombia and FARC and all the rest. Their international expansion has been impressive. They've really mastered the use of drones. They have far more than the Mexican government has. And I think most of us are aware that they have deeply infiltrated the state. Every few years, they form a new police force of the best and the brightest of young Mexican men that tends to be, at some point, perverted by and infiltrated by the cartels. Again, depending on who you read, drug sales in that part of the world, you're talking about maybe gross $40 billion a year. They have between 200,000 and 1 million people working for them, either full or part-time. But one of the more interesting things that came out of it was the self-defense movement, militias, so-called vigilantes. They call themselves community police, among other things. Their first action, if I'm not mistaken, was in 2011, but they didn't really form institutionally until 2013. Some of the groups, like Los Zetas, and there was a cartel called the Knights Templar. Their violence, their brutality reached a point where, especially when the army had a tough time making any headway and no one trusted the local police, formed their own organization. There were certain places in the South, in Guerrero and a few other places, where you had small towns directly enslaved by the cartels. In Guerrero, where the first self-defense organization was founded, so-called community police, in this very poor area. They used initially hunting rifles and whatever they can take from the cartels, who were not expecting this kind of a response. But the state, I shouldn't have to say this, but the state became their number one enemy. Even their registered guns were eventually taken by state actors. The state has done all it can to either diminish their activities or absorb whatever they can into the police services. The state has confiscated many weapons from these people. But these are mostly from poor areas, and they're neglected because, you know, the army only has so many men. At any given time, you have about 45,000 men dedicated to internal drug defense. And this was something that made people very happy. And because of the Indian autonomy, some of the Indian groups who were the first to, and easier gun laws, were some of the first to organize. They were able to take a bite out of the cartels themselves. Down in Guerrero, it was tremendous brutality, extortion, And because of this ethnic feeling that many of the Indians had, they had that foundation to revolt. Eventually, it simply became too much, and no one trusted the state. They started blocking roads, hijacking cartel trucks, all kinds of disobedience to all sides of this conflict. And when some of them began to join together in these poorer areas, not only did the state refuse to help them, but acted against their interests in every possible way. They even created their own court system. The army doesn't have the manpower or the money or the equipment or anything else to cover the entire country. I mean, yes, they're meant to fight enemies domestic or international, domestic or foreign, but nothing is there to be able to cover. They can only be in one place at a time. And we'll talk about tactics here in a second. And everyone is aware of this. And what some of these groups, one of them is called the National Guard, they cite Article 39 of the Mexican Constitution, basically saying all power comes from the population of Mexico. And as a result of that, the people have a right to change the form of government whenever it's necessary. And what else is ever a time where it's necessary? It's now. Native peoples, the Indians, are already basically independent. About 40% of these militias came from these Indian areas. And overall, at their height, they had about 40,000 men. They remind me of the peasant uprisings against the Bolsheviks in the 20s. But some of these guys, there's a couple of very good English language documentaries on them, actually quite sympathetic. And they say that the police plant drugs on them all the time. Any excuse to bring them in and take their money. This is why now those groups refuse to register any weapon that they have, because even the registry doesn't protect them much of the time. This is the best use of the word democracy. Rule by the people who are quite willing to put their lives on the line, especially against Los Zetas, who uses torture as a regular matter. And because of the autonomy that the Indian lands already had, they were the first to take action. And not only against drug cartels, but the cartels were also going after their natural resources. They have their hands in mining, as I already said, oil theft. When they first formed, entire towns showed up at their recruitment drives. As far as I know, they're still functioning. And when you have this massive popular uprising in certain, especially poor areas, against the cartels, that's a huge blow to them. You know, they spend a lot of time helping the poor and all this stuff for PR. Well, the economics of the matter concerning Mexico as a whole, I think is fairly well known. NAFTA was an absolute disaster. The Chiapas revolt that very year meant that NAFTA, you know, they didn't take any of this into consideration, or they simply lied about it. That risk premiums began to increase. Did absolutely nothing against the cartels, in fact, benefited them greatly. The Mexicans saw the economic downfall of so much of their industry, and massive inequalities that this brought about. The central bank, which is not owned by the state, although it's the president offers candidates that can be approved or not by the Senate to run the board, they sold like short-term debt in pesos. But to attract capital, they guaranteed payment in dollars, which is a dangerous method. A few years went by and the inflation rate was 55% yearly, and more Mexican-owned assets were being liquidated. Again, the only economic growth was in the drug trade. So then the central bank used borrowed dollars to buy pesos in order to control value. And of course, they went broke as a result. As years went by, in the 90s, a severe depression came over Mexico. The GDP, just prior, really, roughly 95, 96, GDP decline was about 10% in that period of time. Wages went down on average about 40%. And the only thing that saved them was a massive American bailout. So not only was the regime bailing out the American banks, they were bailing out Mexican banks too. And I've already mentioned the economics of the PRI defeat. The claim that the 1988 election was marred by fraud, 2006 was marred by fraud. And this is roughly the period where cartels then formed to make Mexico the number one origin, or the number one drug supplier to this massive American market. This is when the cartels began buying American-made weapons. And when you had things, you know, this was 2020, where the former Secretary of Defense, Salvador Cienfuegos, was arrested for drug trafficking, and that he was protecting the something called the H2 cartel. And a whole bunch of very high-ranking people were on the dock. 2012, things got worse with the election of Enrique Nieto. He was elected with 38% of the vote, and he was the first PRI candidate in a long time. He began privatizing state assets. We all know what that means. And a huge portion of the officers close to him all went on the dock. Many of these cases fell apart on technicalities. The Mexican courts, as of a few years ago, you had a conviction rate of 2 to 5%. 2017, debt was at a minimum 55% of the GDP, which is about $3 trillion, 12th in the world. And of course, the credit rating is very poor. The poverty rate in Chiapas is 78%. In Guerrero, as I mentioned, 70%. Puebla, 66%. Now, El Salvador had similar problems, but their state was centralized and extremely popular. Mexico is one of the most corrupt states in the world, especially the local level. You have 0.2% of the population controlling over 60% of the wealth, while at least 50 million live in poverty. Between 2006 and 2020, you had 50,000 casualties in this drug war. 400,000, I think I already mentioned, between 06 and 22, 400,000 killed by cartels in one form, that would include soldiers and policemen, and that's probably a very low estimate. Now we know that this, I can't remember her name, Jew that just got allegedly elected president, having even a supermajority in the legislature. I find that very hard to believe, because alas, this Obrador, the president now, and this woman who supported leftist guerrillas when she was younger, she's going to defang the military. Although, as the case with the current president, you somehow campaign against the army. You had the same thing happen in Burma. But the minute you take power, you realize you have no choice but to use them. I have the feeling that the president-elect is there to cut deals and cut in many powerful banks on the trade there. I mean, the Jewish-owned record companies have this Mexican rap that glorifies, no different than gangster rap in America. But it goes deeper than that, because cartels are deeply involved in the election process, especially in southern Mexico. In fact, their election commission requested military assistance to make sure that the election was integral. I don't believe it was, certainly not in her case. In some cases, particularly poor areas that I've mentioned, they control elections entirely. About 20 journalists are killed a year, which, you know, there's a silver lining. Being a journalist down there is very dangerous. I don't really know who's doing the killing. Everyone hates them except the left. Yeah, depending on who's doing the counting, between 6 and 9 major cartels. From 2006 to 2020, of these handful of cartels, 6 times the amount of various drugs have been seized by the authorities, although with no diminution of supply in the U.S., which suggests that the production is extraordinary. And it's not just in terms of these crimes, but even low-level crimes, where NGOs, and you take it for what it's worth, says that the crime rate is pretty much 100% higher than is reported because the overwhelming majority of crime does not get reported, at least in part because the courts can't do anything. They don't have a RICO, although RICO is unconstitutional, but in an emergency, they don't have any choice. They have nothing like that. They've been prevented from passing any real anti-gang legislation. And because you're still dealing with a third world state, NAFTA just increased that, you have what's called the forensic crisis. Police departments at various levels don't have the training or the technology to really investigate. Being Americanized, you have the huge health problems in terms of obesity with soldiers, the actual National Guard, not the self-defense group, in 2021 admitted that, well, they put it in a very strange way, that they couldn't verify 90% of its own men as fit for service. I think one of the things that this president-elect is going to do is follow at least some court rulings that say that the Army it's unconstitutional for the Army to be involved in domestic concerns. And what the state would do is another matter. But it was really 2000 and 2003 when the Army was first called out and given broad powers in dealing with the cartels. And they've either been ineffective or the cartels are growing faster than the Army can take them down. Because local police were completely unreliable, in fact, federal police were completely unreliable 20 years ago, the Army was called out or the state would fall apart entirely. Federal police were dismantled in 2001, replaced by the Federal Investigative Agency. Between 1995 and 2000, and that's a 5-year period, 150 military officers were tried for drug-related crimes. Very few of them were actually convicted, but that 150 has got to be a fairly low number. In short, the economic disaster of Mexico over the last few decades, massive inequality and poverty, the enormous market for drugs in America and partly Canada. The Army has been ineffective at making war on cartels. For the most part, have militias that are better trained and better armed than anything that the Army can throw at them. You know, they dismantle various agencies and then reorganize them and they get taken over. There's been pitched battles between cartels and the Army that the Army has lost. They have their own training camps. They have their own intelligence. I've mentioned everything that they have, their armored system, and it's just getting better as time goes on. So why is this the case? Why has this war, as of now, been largely a disaster for the Mexican state as well as the Army? Well, I've mentioned some of this already. Official corruption is probably the number one reason. This is what happens when there's simply too much money to be made and easily laundered. Mass poverty, especially because it's localized poverty. as this nouveau riche group in Mexico has become wealthier and wealthier, largely connected with the oligarchs in the U.S. In much of the country, the central state is very weak, almost non-existent. The flow of weapons from the U.S., taken back by immigrants, including very sophisticated weapons, but the very same people that could sneak drugs into a country can sneak weapons out of the country. The distrust of institutions in general. Believe it or not, the most popular government institution is the Navy. The Marine Corps has done quite well against the cartels. The regime will go on and on about human rights abuses by the army, as if that doesn't happen in war. But they're under these strictures, the cartels, and very specific militia groups connected to them, use torture and violence, you know, deliberately showing bodies and disfigured bodies and putting them in a town, torture, intimidation. It's extremely difficult to go against them, especially in poor areas. U.S. immigration policy. I talked about in the El Salvador case that immigrants are being sent to North America for weapons, for training, and brought back. The gang situation in Los Angeles, for example, that's what created the gang situation in El Salvador, not the other way around. Once the PRI fell from power, that agreement that I mentioned early on fell apart. The state was no longer stable. The first thing that happened when the PRI was essentially driven from power was that not only do you have the multi-party system, but the state fell apart equally. Cartels have top-shelf soldiers and mercenaries, overwhelmingly former military. They're bringing the military organization, not just in Mexico, but in Central America too, into the cartel mobilization. I mentioned the Los Zetas already, probably the most violent of these militias. They were formed in 1997, where an entire company, or I should really say a small company, the Elite Airborne Corps, I think it was 31 precisely, defected and went to the cartels. Cartels have high-tech methods, you know, jamming cell phones, these kind of things, where they're free to operate even in the prison system. And given, as I've said, the army is hamstrung as to where it can go at any given time, their enforcement has to be selective. The lack of manpower and the lack of material resources is a huge part of this. But because of the infiltration of the cartels in various levels of police agency, local, state, federal, army, National Guard, etc., inter-unit, inter-agency coordination and cooperation is minimum. Because if they don't trust a certain unit, say local cops, they're not going to share information because they think the local cops are going to go to the cartels, which is often the case. And that sowing of distrust has caused a tremendous amount of damage. As I've mentioned, the cartels are better trained, they're better armed, and they have roughly the manpower of the army. The concept of political office in Mexico wasn't so much this disinterested concern for the public good, but it was a way of charging rents, of gaining power and wealth at the expense of everybody else. Intimidation, you know, so many politicians, especially on the campaign trail, have been killed. Intimidation is very easy when you know they could back it up at any moment. The desertion. I've mentioned that already, and that's something I didn't know until fairly recently. 100,000 desertions between 2000 and 2006 from the army. From 2006 to 2009, 60,000 more. Although once pay was increased, that fell off. But clearly it's not the only factor. Cartel informants, this is a massive network. In the legislature, in the presidential office, the highest levels of the army, and even within the U.S. embassy, which shouldn't surprise anybody. I think as of a couple of years ago, the armed forces a member of the mid-level member of the armed forces getting about $1,100 a month. When they join a cartel, they're getting at least $3,000 a week. I mentioned the weak court system, between 1 to 3, depending on who you read, percent of cases lead to convictions. The government austerity policy coming from its own depression, as I already mentioned, which makes the government even less popular. The vigilante groups, which could have been the nucleus of a new form of government, rather than being encouraged, they were attacked. So they have to fight the cartels on the one side and the state on the other. One of the consequences here is that this isn't just, you know, like in America, organized crime generally wants to avoid, at least the older generations, want to avoid killing agents of the government. It's just not worth it to kill a policeman. Jewish mafia does, but no one talks about them. But this is different. This is a war on the state as such. It's a zero-sum game as far as legitimacy is concerned. And I mentioned, as Mexico grew into this huge hub of the drug trade, where it wasn't 40 years ago, the attacks of the state on them lead to fragmentation. Fragmentation, the proliferation of groups. So now you have 9 big ones and a few minor ones. That just increases violence because they end up fighting each other constantly for territory. I saw a Pew Research poll. About 26% of Mexicans greatly trust the army. A majority trust them to some level or another. But only 6% said the same about local police. The way that the army has functioned, either the concentration of forces or the use of special ops. They could flood an area with troops, which is unpopular with locals, but it could drive out concentrated cartel forces. And of course, the use of special forces have been very successful, although only in a localized and sporadic way. The Marines, as I mentioned, have done very well in this respect. But given American pressure, cartels are not considered military adversaries. They're still criminals. They're not officially called terrorist groups, despite the fact that they engage in terrorist methods. They do kill civilians on purpose. Therefore, the army is not on a war footing. And that's gotten worse over the last few years. In general, the Navy is seen as the most politically reliable. The money is good. The Los Zetas, as I mentioned already, are the most proficient force, and they've been very successful against the army. I think local police have been, I mean, you have entire police forces all over the country that have been fired, and federal or army forces have moved in. In fact, many civilian, a huge percentage actually of civilian public safety officers have been filled by former military. And the theory is, and this is true, I mean, compared to local cops, the army is not nearly as corrupt. By comparison, that so many of these militias come from military defectors that, you know, again, I don't want to exaggerate this because working for them is a huge risk in and of itself. You know, cartels don't have to worry about due process or human rights. Their very existence is an assault on however you want to define human rights. That seems to escape the left, who, in fact, always identifies with criminal elements, romanticizes criminal elements. They see themselves in the cartels. There are good local police departments. I just can't think of any off the top of my head. The Army, the federal civilian security services. With the fragmentation of the state, it went along with the fragmentation of the cartel system. Each fragment being extremely wealthy and capable of tremendous acts of violence among each other, building their military forces. Only when the PRI lost power did the agreement that I've already mentioned fell apart. And this happens roughly at the same time that the Colombian cartels were reduced in strength. So those two things happening at the same time was an absolute disaster. But if you're a cartel member, it was a very, very good thing. And it was about the year 2000, maybe a little bit before, Vicente Fox came in. The PRI no longer had this agreement that I mentioned with the cartels. The understanding that we can't beat them. The money is too good. They're too powerful. However, we can alleviate the effects of their rule over the country. As I've said before, you can't have a war on drugs and have an army not function on a war footing. They still have to follow due process, as if these are just criminals. There is no due process for Japanese or German soldiers in World War II or Chinese in Korea. You couldn't possibly run a war that way. And when you have a clear emergency, the dissolution, of no matter how bad the state is, it is infinitely preferable to the local mafia that can offer people a huge amount of money despite the risks involved in working for them. You would think that a cartel wants to keep the lowest profile possible, but they regularly kill politicians, both in office and those especially running for office. And there's a few reasons for this, and this is pretty important to understand how they operate. That killing of candidates and politicians happens in places that already are involved with very intense battles with the state or each other. It also happens in areas where the local police and the local ruling class, say a governor, is from a party that rivals the party at the federal level. The president of party X, the governor of party Y, there's this division that cartels can exploit. And it shouldn't surprise you that this happens a lot during election years, off year and otherwise, because, you know, politicians are often campaigning to crush the local cartel, and many of them don't get very far. And the other factor where cartels kill politicians, keeping them from running on this platform, is when it's happening in neighboring areas. And this is part of the reason why even local cops, local police chiefs, are often retired military men. And when military men come into, let's say, a governorship, or maybe at the county level, as the head law enforcement official there, they end up purging the political class and the police like crazy, because most of them are well known to be on the take with these people. In many of them, it's not voluntary. In certain places, you just have to listen. You're not going to last long against them, so you do what you can to cooperate to the minimum possible way. So it's about 60% of these offices. But in terms of the population, it depends, again, on who you read, but about 80 to 85% of the population back the use of the military against the cartels, regardless of its results in terms of effectiveness. 98%, not quite, wanted military men to be incorporated into the police if the military simply is sent back to their barracks. And only 17% total were suspicious of this kind of behavior. Interestingly enough, about half of Mexicans think there is some progress being made in the war, and 30% believe that they're losing ground. A lot, and the rest say that everything is staying the same. This is why the war so far has been a failure, and I don't want to ever underestimate the financial aspect. Austerity policies, bankruptcy, this only benefits the cartels. The cartels have a lot more money to spend. than the state itself, and the state being highly divided. But more importantly, the fact that so many of these profits are being laundered through American institutions. You have the occasional arrest. But given the sheer amount of cash involved here every year, every quarter, this is keeping certain institutions afloat. It would be just like if you cut off illegal immigration, the oligarchs would lose a huge source of labor. I'm always surprised about how dependent the corporate economy in America is on illegal and semi-legal immigration. At the same time, I'm always surprised about the extent to which drug money is extremely important to keep the stock market where it is, at least according to some of these people, even at the UN, as I already cited. It's not as if this is I'm not a big fan of legalization, especially when it comes to meth, whatever. Maybe the PRI had it right. Maybe that was all you can do. But it's declaring a complete surrender of the moral high ground. You can't claim that crime is falling when you start legalizing things that used to be called crimes. 50% say that there is progress being made. Maybe they know more than we do. But when you have millions to give in even a small area, everybody can be corrupted despite the fact. And the desertions come from a whole bunch of causes, as we all know, lost battles, corruption in the upper ranks. We're not going to die for a system that doesn't care if we're here or not, that goes after the grassroots militia movement that could be effective against the cartels. But apparently only cartels are allowed to have 50 calibers on a regular basis and use drones as a way to compensate for a lack of air power. About the only benefit that the military has is in armored helicopters. You know, F-16s don't matter in this kind of war. And yet in Afghanistan, the Taliban has already completely wiped out the heroin trade. But there's a religious element there. There's a militancy. There's a motivation. They don't have much money. And you're talking about one of the poorest countries on the planet. It's not to say this can't be done. So if you want to try to figure out why it's not, then there has to be reasons above and beyond your typical soldier, your typical policeman, in extremely difficult situations. There's too many elites that benefit from this. And now with this new president going in, who's going to be able to rule absolutely, given these alleged mass majorities in the legislature, and even at the local level, things are going to get worse as she pulls the army in. Her benefactors in corporate America, or really corporate Mexico City, are not going to allow this massive source of income to become truncated. And that's my opinion on the cartel situation. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.